Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. If last year was an indication of what's to come, we can expect a lot of activism on college campuses this year. Last year, students took on a number of issues, including sexual assault and rape, police violence, racial discrimination, wages, and free speech. Black student unions at all 9 University of California campuses voted for a resolution calling for divestment of prison corporations. So in December, the UC sold $25 million of its prison stocks. And then in November, thousands of students across the country rallied to demand tuition-free public college, a $15 an hour minimum wage for campus workers, and an end to rising student debt. So joining me on today's Your Call to talk about the wave of student activism sweeping the country are three guests. Angus Johnston is an historian of American student organizing. He teaches at the City University of New York and runs the blog studentactivism.net. And he wrote about student activism in the December issue of Rolling Stone. And Angus joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Hi, Angus. Welcome to the show.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Anthony Williams is the Prison Divestment Communications Director and Editor-in-Chief for the African Black Coalition. That's an organization created in 2003 by black students within the University of California system who found the low admittance and retention rates of black students intolerable. Anthony is also a Mellon Mays undergrad fellow at UC Berkeley, where he studies sociology, theater, and performance studies. And Anthony Williams joins me in studio. Hi, Anthony. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Sophie Karasik is an anti-sexual violence activist and co-founder of the group End Rape on Campus. Prior to her graduation from UC Berkeley last year, Sophie spearheaded several federal complaints against UC Berkeley and has assisted students nationwide in holding universities accountable. Sophie is featured in the documentary The Hunting Ground. It exposes rape crimes on college campuses. And Sophie joins us on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Sophie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Angus Johnston, let's start off with you. You have studied contemporary student activism. You run a blog about this. And we are seeing so much activism and protests getting a lot more attention. You believe that it seems to be accelerating. What do you expect this year?
I think it is. And I think that one of the things that we see over and over again is that there are sort of waves and lulls of student protest, but that there do seem to be these moments when students start standing up for themselves in a variety of different ways around a variety of different issues. And that tends to build on itself, particularly when they start getting media attention. It's clear to me that these protests that we saw in the fall are bigger than we've seen in quite a very long time, and that they look to be only getting bigger in the spring.
And what is driving this upswing in activism?
Well, we've seen a lot of activism in the last 6 or 8 years, but for quite some time it was being repressed, suppressed by university officials. And what we've seen in the last year or two is that students are rising up, students protesting against racism on campus, against sexual violence on campus, who are, frankly, a lot harder for university officials to roust with impunity. And particularly after the UC Davis pepper spray incident. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, there's a lot more media attention and public attention on violent police tactics on campus. And so I think that the groundswell that we've seen is one that universities have a very hard time knowing how to shut down.
It's so interesting that you bring up that pepper spray incident at UC Davis. I went back to the school 6 or 8 months after that happened, and so many students said, you know, this is not a campus where we spend that much time talking about capitalism. And because of that incident, we are now talking about capitalism in our classes. It would be so interesting to find some of those students who were sprayed. It's been 4 or 5 years?
I think it was 2011.
Right. So to find out where they are now. Anthony Williams, what are your thoughts on this? What do you think explains this upswing in activism that we're seeing?
I would say that it's a big movement that we see all over the world nationally. So I studied abroad in South Africa last year. And when I got back, the Rhodes Must Fall campaign launched to get rid of the statue of Cecil John Rhodes and colonialism and capitalism on campus. And then recently they also had their Fees Must Fall. So when I see this movement, I see social media is a big part of it, and that we know about a lot of what's going on all over the world. And so it helps us. When we think about at the African Black Coalition, we think about the whole black diaspora, right? And so that includes people who are in the continent, people who are in our country. And when we see them fighting and when we fight with them, there's a certain amount of solidarity that happens within us and then across different movements, right? And so Black Lives Matter is working directly with people in, like, in looking at all over. There's North American chapters, there's chapters all over the world, and it's not just about black people, right, but all marginalized people. And I think seeing that is what really motivates other people to continue to activate and move and shake.
And Angus, that's another change that we are seeing in the past, say, 5 or so years, that so many marginalized communities are now using their voices.
Absolutely. The student body in the United States has changed dramatically over the course of the last 50 years. It used to be mostly white, mostly male, mostly what they would call college age, and mostly people from an elite economic background. And all of that has changed. But the university hasn't really changed with it. Hmm. And so one of the things that we're absolutely seeing is pressure from students of color, from women, from non-traditional students, from queer students, saying that the way that the university has been run up until now is not hospitable and fitting our needs, and demanding that it begin to change.
And that's exactly what we saw in The Hunting Ground, Sophie. This is a documentary that exposes rape crimes on college campuses. We had you and Kirby Dick, the director of the film, on last year. And in the film, you know, students are outraged because administrators are not taking sexual assault and rape seriously. And it was just incredible to see so many young women and some men who've been sexually assaulted or raped, which is incredibly traumatic, and then organize across the country to say, no, we are going to pressure administrators to actually take this seriously. Can you talk a little bit about that, and just what do you remember from the days when you first started?
Sure, yeah. I think it really can't be overstated the importance of networked activism, both in this movement against campus sexual assault, but also across student movements nationally and internationally. So in the case of the movement against campus rape, what we were able to do was to connect over Facebook and Twitter and Skype and actually file complaints, federal complaints against our institutions, alleging that federal laws had been violated, that institutions were actually discriminating on the basis of gender by allowing rape to continue unabated on their college campuses and to sweep it under the rug. And so we were talking over Skype until late at night using Google Docs and, you know, sending these documents without lawyers to the Department of Education and getting them to investigate our institution. And that was something that became very interesting to the media, and other students were able to see that was going on and be inspired by that and use those tactics as well. I think that there's a lot of inspiration that students have been able to get from one another, and I think that we definitely saw that with the mattress protests that happened at campuses across the country, where students were carrying mattresses in solidarity with survivors of campus sexual assault, inspired by Emma Sokolowitz at Columbia University. So I think that there has been a lot of activism on this issue, and that it's going to continue for a while.
You mentioned Emma Sokolowitz. In 2014, she carried a mattress everywhere she went in protest of Columbia, which she said failed to expel her rapist. And then her action inspired students at 130 other colleges to do the same?
Yes, it was at least 130, I would imagine. There were a number of protests that happened across the country where survivors were carrying mattresses and their allies were carrying mattresses and saying that, you know, we're fed up with the epidemic of campus sexual assault that we have known about for decades on this campus, and that I think that both for this movement and also for many of the other movements that we've discussed too, the importance of personal narrative and being able to feel like you can share your story and be connected with other people who have undergone the same oppressions and terrible experiences is something that's been very, very powerful, and that we've been able to bridge geographical boundaries in order to create the image of, you know, this is something that's a national and an international problem, both with the usage of social media and then also media framing when you have, you know, Ferguson, Baltimore, New York, Oakland, all of those different cities, and then you have all of these campuses all across the country, you're able to create this conscious raising frame that this is something that's happening all over the country, not just isolated to any one particular place.
That is Sophie Karasik. She's an anti-sexual violence activist and co-founder of End Rape on Campus. Prior to her graduation from UC Berkeley last year, she spearheaded several federal complaints against UC Berkeley and has assisted students across the country. She's featured in the documentary The Hunting Ground, which exposes rape crimes on college campuses. The Hunting Ground has been picked up by CNN, and it did air in December a couple of times. We're checking to see if it's going to air in January. And I believe, Sophie, is it available on Netflix?
It is not available on Netflix, but it is on, I believe, Amazon and potentially YouTube. You can definitely rent it online.
Okay, great. So that, again, it's called The Hunting Ground. We're also joined by Anthony Williams, Prison Divestment Communications Director and Editor-in-Chief of the African Black Coalition, an organization created in 2003 by black students within the UC system who found the low admittance and retention rates of black students intolerable. Anthony is an undergrad fellow at UC Berkeley. He studies sociology, theater, and performance studies. And Angus Johnston is a historian of American student organizing. He teaches at the City University of New York, and he runs the blog studentactivism.net. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about student activism across the country. We saw so much activism last year affecting a number of issues: sexual assault, racial discrimination, wages, free speech. And we are expecting that to continue this year. If you are a student, we'd love to hear from you. What are you seeing at your campus? What are you involved in? What is most effective when it comes to student activism? If you're an educator, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you're connected to a college, what really strikes you about the kind of student activism that you are seeing today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Angus, again, you're a historian. You run a blog about these issues. Can you talk about demands? It's interesting to see that students have come up with a tangible set of demands, whether it's sexual assault, racial discrimination, wages, and how has that really changed over the years?
That's really a fascinating thing. In the wave of student protests that you saw in about 6 or 8 years ago, as I described, including the Occupy California protests that preceded Occupy Wall Street, there was a tendency, not universal, but there was a tendency to have demands list protests where you would occupy a building or take over a space on campus, and you were just pushing for wholesale large-scale changes. And what we're seeing now is a lot more specificity in demands. And part of this is coming out of the fact that these protests tend to be coming from more specifically oriented interest groups on campus who have particular policy changes that they would like to see. But one of the things that we're seeing as a result of this, and as a result of the incredible media and social media attention that today's protests are seeing, is that a list of demands that's maybe put together by a group of a couple dozen students at the end of a very, very long day an environment where they don't necessarily know each other very well in some cases, and they just sort of put together a provisional list of demands and put it up on their blog or whatever it is, suddenly there's this incredible feeding frenzy from the national media to go over those demands and pick them apart and find the one that was carelessly phrased or perhaps carelessly thought out, and hold it up as an example of everything that is wrong with the student movement. And so one of the things that we are seeing now is that a lot of these movements are getting a lot more careful in terms of how they're writing their demands because they know that kind of backlash is coming. But at the same time, they're getting a lot more ambitious because the more that they protest and the more that they engage in this organizing, the more that they come to understand the actual power systems on campus and the way that power works. And so rather than, for instance, demanding that the university president implement some sort of a reform, they're demanding the creation of some sort of a new mechanism by which students can get involved directly in making changes to the campuses. And so one of the things that I'm really going to be looking out for this semester is the ways that students' demands in these protests evolve.
And Anthony, would you talk a little bit about how you and your colleagues and other students at the African Black Coalition goes about creating a set of demands? What goes on behind the scenes? So as Angus was saying, you know that it is going to be picked apart by the media, mm-hmm. and you're going to have to be able to defend your list of demands.
Mm-hmm. Well, first and foremost, we are Black, and then we're university students, right? And so we think about both of those things when we're going through this process. And so we think about what is actually personal for us. For a lot of us, if you speak to many Black people, regardless of class status, most of us have a family member who has been in or out of jail. If it's not a direct family member, it's second cousin or somebody, but generally it happens, right? And so we think about the personal, but like I said, we're students. So we also do tremendous amount of research. And then we work with other people to make sure that we are not just the ones doing the research and we're not reinventing the wheel, right? So with our prison divestment campaign, we worked with Enlace, which is an organization that works in the U.S. and in Mexico, and they work on things like prison divestment and making sure that workers and people of color and people who are of different class statuses are being protected. Another organization we worked with was the Responsible Endowments Coalition. And when we work with these organizations and we do the research, we make sure that when we released our demands, which are up on our website, when we released our resolution, which then we put out with the demands as well, it has footnotes for every statistic that we're talking about. And so it's not just we as Black students want this, right? It's like there's reasons, and the University of California system should not be investing in private prisons, right? That's it's just the given. But then we also give you research that tells you why, you know, this is wrong. And so there's a whole process that goes through it. But it takes a lot of leadership and it takes people stepping up, right? So I'm the communications director. I wasn't involved in creating the resolutions, but I was involved in pushing out the resolutions, right? And that's all necessary because most of this work that we do is unpaid.
Right. And then you're also a student.
Yes.
In addition to doing this. So you worked with Black student unions at all 9 UC campuses, and they adopted resolutions demanding the UC system to divest from prisons. What was your organizing strategy behind that?
So we had a 5-month campaign, essentially. Enlace in 2013, in the spring of 2013, found out that the University of California had these investments. We got the research from Enlace, and our political director created a lot of different campaigns working with our executive staff. And over the summer, what we do is a Black student leadership training. So in the summer, our field organizer, Camilla Moore, and our political director, Yoel Haley, they put together a PowerPoint, right? A very simple PowerPoint that put together all of the historical facts that talk about private prisons. So the first step was education. We educated each other. We educated different chairs of the different BSUs, including CSUs. It was the 9 UCs that voted on the resolution, but we have CSUs and other universities within our CSUs being California State Universities within our ranks. And so the education was a factor. And then we made sure that this is something that everyone was on board with, right? And that because we represent the students, right, we represent the students of California, we're a statewide coalition, we want to make sure that they're all on board with what we're going forward. So it was education, it was knowing who to speak to, we had meetings with the CIO, with the UC Office of the President, and by doing that directly while also putting pressure in the media, I think that was one of the biggest reasons we had the success.
And so in December, the UC system sold $25 million in prison stocks.
Yes. Yeah. And those are in 3 different private prison corporations. And the next goal actually is, so they, if you read any of our press releases and then some of their responses, the UC does not officially divest. And so one of the things that we're actually trying to get them to do, their reasoning is that if we're going to sell as risk managers of $100 billion portfolio, right? If we're going to sell stocks in something, especially as small, in their case, it's 25 million, but very large for us. If we're going to sell that, we're not going to buy it back, right? But we want to make sure that there is an official official policy that the UC will never again invest in private prisons because it's not sustainable, it's immoral, and it's disgusting, honestly.
And so that's next?
That's next. And then there's also Wells Fargo. So the University of California has $425 million invested in Wells Fargo. And Wells Fargo, if people don't know, outside of the history of discriminatory lending, they also essentially fund the private prison industry. They have over 1 million shares in private prison corporations. They are a I forget the term. What is it? I have it written down. The syndication agent and issuing lender on CCA's like $785 million line of credit. And then they also have $95.5 million invested through mutual funds in Geo Group. And that comes from Jails Fargo, which is a report by the National People's Action of 2012. And so when you look at these numbers, right, that's not a bank you want to invest in, especially when Wells Fargo is, they have a campaign right now about Black people's untold stories, what it means to be African American. And so it's really ridiculous that you're going to talk about this given your history and given that you're funding these private prisons, and not just private prisons, but also immigrant detention centers.
Right.
And so it's laughable in a lot of ways when you think about it, but it's very real and it's still happening. And the UC is investing $425 million in Wells Fargo. So the next step is to get them to sell those shares as well.
And so this was a major victory.
Huge victory. Yeah. And we've been very happy, and we kind of didn't expect it to happen so quickly. Because, I mean, if you look at Columbia, it took 2 years, right? And if you consider when the research came out to now, there is a longer process, right? But it's amazing that we've had this victory in this time.
Angus, what are your thoughts on this victory?
It's really exciting, and it really is an example of what I'm talking about, of student activists going up against the university as an institution and looking to transform the university as an institution. And what Anthony just said about moving beyond this short-term victory to trying to create a new policy, a public policy, that by which the university would stand behind a commitment not to reinvest in these kinds of funds, really reflects the other big, big challenge that students have, which is that students are by their nature transient. They enroll, they stay for a few years, and then they leave. Mm-hmm. And one of the big, big challenges of any student movement is, how do you make sure that your victories outlast your time on campus? And one of the things that I'm seeing right now throughout the country, and both of your other guests are really good examples of this, is students taking on that question head on and trying to figure out how to build structures and provisions and institutions on campus that will allow their victories to extend far into the future. It's a very, very exciting moment.
Well, Sophie, you graduated from UC Berkeley last year, and you did so much you were involved in so much activity when it comes to anti-sexual violence. So how do you plan to continue this work and remain in contact with students today?
Yeah, so I'm definitely still in contact with students on the ground in Berkeley. I'm actually quite fortunate in that I now do this work full-time as the Director of Education at NRAPE on Campus, the organization that I started a couple years ago. And so I've fortunately been able to go back to Berkeley and continue to meet with students and survivors and talk about what's changed and what happened, and to also be able to keep those connections open because of social media and because we're talking so regularly about all of these discussions that we're seeing in the media. I think that we, as Anthony pointed out, are really trying to make sure that we're educating ourselves about all of these various issues, and then we're trying to make sure that the solutions are coming from the people who are affected by the problem. So in the instance of the campus sexual violence movement, I was running trainings with other students of, like, what federal laws exist regarding sexual assault and gender discrimination? What is the policy on our, in this case, Berkeley campus? And what are the things that we want to see changed? And also, as Anthony was saying, you know, doing lots of research about what people are experiencing, and then moving from there, thinking, okay, so we know that this particular thing is a problem. What would be a potential solution for this? So, for example, when people often think that, oh, survivors should just go to the police. Mm. Well, there are a number of reasons why people don't want to go to law enforcement after having been sexually assaulted. but, you know, we wouldn't know those reasons unless we talked to survivors. Mm-hmm. So we're really trying to make sure that we're continuing to have those channels of communication open, and that we're ensuring that institutional memory isn't lost.
Sophie Karasik is an anti-sexual violence activist and co-founder of End Rape on Campus. Anthony Williams is Prison Divestment Communications Director with the African Black Coalition. And Angus Johnston is an historian of American student organizing. And today on Your Call, we are talking about activism on college campuses. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard on today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. And on today's World Have Your Say at 11, Chloe Tilley discusses the starvation of Syrian citizens. What's the truth? She talks to residents and aid workers, journalists, and others. And she also discusses race relations in South Africa. That's at 11 today on World Have Your Say from the BBC here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of the diplomatic crisis between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We will also discuss coverage of the State Department's response to the Saudi execution of a Shiite dissident and Saudi Arabia's public relations campaign to shape how the news is covered here in the United States. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about student activism on college campuses across the country. We saw so much activism last year and a lot of media coverage on a number of issues: sexual assault and rape, free speech, racial discrimination, wages. We're expected to see a lot more this year, and we're talking about it with Angus Johnston, an historian of American student organizing. He teaches at City University of New York, runs the blog studentactivism.net. Anthony Williams is the Prison Divestment Communications Director with the African Black Coalition, an organization that was created by Black students within the UC system who found the low admittance and retention rates of Black students intolerable. In addition to all this work, Anthony is a Mellon Mays undergrad fellow at UC Berkeley. He studies sociology, theater, and performance studies. Sophie Karasik is an anti-sexual violence activist and co-founder of End Rape on Campus. She graduated from UC Berkeley last year and spearheaded several federal complaints against UC Berkeley. She is featured in the documentary The Hunting Ground, which I hope you can see. You can search for it online and watch it online. Anthony, before the break, we were talking about how activists stay involved after they leave school and how they stay connected with their victories. So since the African Black Coalition had a major victory pressuring the UC system to divest in prisons, which it did in December, $25 million, what are your thoughts on this? How do students stay involved in this?
So one of the things that I think about this a lot, I'm not just a part of ABC, I do other things, as you just announced. And when I think about the transients earlier that Angus was talking about, I think about our organization and how we're actually in a really good setup. So we have our organizational structures. We have a central committee, which is actually current university students, and they elect the executive staff, and executive staff cannot be students. They have to have graduated. And then we represent the different BSUs all over the state of California. And so when I think about this model, right, we're making sure that the students are the ones who are in power, and then the people who have graduated are still involved, right? And so my role is a role that I can, as an editor-in-chief and as prison divestment communications director, I can maintain that afterwards. And so one of the things we have to think about is making sure that we do maintain those connections, as Sophie was saying. And not all of us are as fortunate to get paid for this work, right? We can't all get full-time jobs. And that was something that Sophie brought up, right? But you can't always stay involved. And so even with our press releases, we've had alumni who've reached out to us through email mm-hmm. and said, I want to stay involved and I want to help you out. And so I think the best bet is making sure that you visit your alma mater and making sure that you speak to these different students and what's going on, because the students are making these decisions, and it's huge. When you think about the UC having $100 billion invested, it's not just a student problem, right? It's like a huge, there's like pensioners, there's the University of California Regents, there's a bunch of different people who are invested into the system. It's a public university. And so people need to get more involved, whether they're a student, have been, or will ever be.
And if you are a recent college grad or a student and you're involved in any kinds of movements on campus, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you're working on. What do you think is most effective? If you're an educator or connected somehow to a campus, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or if you just care about these issues and you're inspired by what you're seeing on college campuses today, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have for our guests? What are your thoughts about what's most effective? What do you think of the media coverage of all of these movements? 866-798-8255. The email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Angus, when it comes to raising awareness about where the school is invested, who are the Board of Regents? How does that process work? Is this something that you also talk about in the classroom?
I don't tend to teach a lot about the history of student movements or and even less so about contemporary student movements. But I do advise student groups around the country, and I work with them. I go out and speak on campuses and that kind of stuff. And so when we're doing that kind of stuff, one of the things that is absolutely crucial is understanding that the university has sort of a dual nature. It is simultaneously a community and an institution. And both of those facts really need to be understood. It's a community in the sense that, if you are a student, particularly at a residential college, you are not only taking classes there, you are spending your free time there, a lot of it. You are living there. You are eating there. You are, in many cases, working there. You are, participating in organizations, you're falling in love, you're doing all of these different things. There's a tendency nowadays to describe students as consumers of higher education, but that concept really is insufficient to describe the full range of experiences that students have. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's absolutely crucial for students to be engaged in protest and in activism, because the university is their home. It is where they live and it is where they work, and it is also where they study. And so they are as much citizens of the university as they are anything else, and they have rights as citizens. Which means then that the second element of it, the university as an institution, is really, really important. There are ways in which students can have power within those institutions and build power within those institutions. But in order to do that, one of the things that you need to do is you need to understand how the institution works. And as Anthony Williams could tell you, one of the absolute most difficult and most fundamental questions in trying to achieve divestment is just figuring out in the first place where your university is invested, because there's a tremendous amount of opacity in how universities are invested, where they are putting their money, where they are spending their money, and who gets to decide all of these questions. The push for transparency in university governance, particularly in financial governance, is one of the most important threads of contemporary student activism.
Well, and Anthony, thanks to the student activism at UC Berkeley, a lot of people who maybe are not connected to the UC system were learning about the regents, who they are, what they do. When they get together in these meetings, what kinds of decisions are they making? Why aren't they letting students appear? I mean, this started getting a lot of media attention last year.
Yeah, and that's the really I think it's Johnson earlier was speaking about the demands, right? And that's the thing that UC Berkeley actually had a set of demands that they released to the chancellor. The chancellor didn't respond in the time that the BSU at the University of California, Berkeley wanted. And there's a whole media campaign around this, right? And there's a lot of press around this. And what actually ended up happening is the African-American Student Initiative, which met some of those demands, right? Looking at like why we don't have enough black psychologists on campus, why we don't have a black resource center. And if you look at the demands of Mizzou and all these different universities, Yale, all over, they often actually mirror the demands of like 40 or 50 years ago that were never met. And so you can see there's a through line. So these demands that people sometimes critique, as he was saying earlier, they're actually necessary, right? And if we are the citizens of this university, of these different universities, then we should be treated as such and we should be treated fairly.
And Sophie, when we're talking about research, it was really incredible in the hunting ground to watch you and other young women do extensive research, sometimes via Skype, to learn about the law and to learn about what colleges can and cannot do when it comes to sexual violence, and then also learn about why it's in their best interest to make sure that their numbers are really low when it comes to rape and sexual assault on campus. And did this trickle into the classroom?
Well, I think that to jump off of what Anthony was saying earlier about his demands being things that we've been reiterating for 40, 50 years, I think that we've also seen that in this movement as well, in the anti-sexual violence movement, that a lot of what we've been demanding, you know, for there to be a fair, adequate adjudication process with people who are trained in trauma, these are things that we've been asking for years. And so I think that it's incredibly powerful that we've been able to connect over Skype and be able to talk about these things that we've been able to discover. So, for example, at Berkeley, I did a lot of research into the archives of the student newspaper and found out that there was a group of women who had filed a Title IX complaint against Berkeley just a few years after Title IX had become federal law, saying basically the same thing that we were saying years and years later. And so I think that it's been incredibly important for us to be able to connect over Skype and to be able to talk about what we can learn from our predecessors.
Well, we have an email from Janelle who says, "These young students give me hope for the future. They are wonderfully focused, articulate, and informed, learning how to create positive cultural change. My 78-year-old radical heart blesses their young determination. Thank you for the hope in a grim landscape."
Wow. Thank you for that. I did a fist pump, not like a regular fist pump, but like, you know, that's really beautiful to hear.
Yeah. Thank you so much for emailing, Janelle. And if you'd like to get in touch with our guest today, if you have any thoughts about student activism, if you go to college, we'd love to hear from you. If you are an alumni and you want to talk about how you're still connected, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we are going to take a caller in just a couple of minutes. Do you want to talk a little bit more, Anthony, about what inspires students to get involved? Because before the show, I was reading what you're doing. You're studying sociology, theater, and performance, which is a lot.
Yes.
And you're a student, right? But then you're doing all of this volunteer work. So can you talk about how students are really balancing all of that?
Yeah, I can tell you that often we're not. So there's you know, something has to fail. And so often for a lot of us, that ends up being our social life. Some people don't want to give up their social life. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes sometimes academics, right? This past semester, it was very hard. I was struggling with anxiety, with depression. Mm-hmm. And that was some of my own things, but also having to deal with the Black Death that was like 2015 for Black people, for Native people, for Indigenous people, for queer people, and for differently abled people was a disgusting year. It was really traumatizing. And yet I ended up making it through. We had this huge divestment win. I got all A's, but I didn't get enough sleep. I wasn't taking care of my body very well. I wasn't always taking care of my mind. And that's it's something that we don't talk about enough. And it's a huge reality in student activism is that it's just too hard to do. You know, I'm a co-chair of an organization. I'm the editor-in-chief and prison divestment communications director. I also work and then I act. And so there's a lot of different things that I do, and all of them are things I really want to do, right? And this this last year for me was the year that I really politicized after returning. I studied abroad in 2014, and I returned at the end of 2014. And after I got back, seeing South Africa and seeing a country that's only 21 years out of apartheid, or I guess 22 now that it's 2016, it's so much more than just reading about it in a class. I took a class for a semester. It's being in that place and feeling it in the air. It's just so visceral. And so when I came back, I had to. You know, I know that I'm doing too much, but I know that I also have to, because if not, who else?
For those of us who have not been to South Africa, what stands out for you? What does it feel like?
I studied at the University of Cape Town, and the University of Cape Town, this is the best way I think about it. The University of Cape Town, the land was technically donated by Cecil John Rhodes, but how does a white man who actually wasn't native to that country come in and donate that land that wasn't his to someone else? But he donated it, right? Or endowed it. And the university was set up to look like an Ivy League university. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. Great buildings. There's ivy. But it's set to look over the city, because the idea is that you are above everyone else. So you're looking down on everyone else. And it's also really an ableist campus. There's like over 100 steps, I counted one day, that you walk up the hill. And so you have to get driven on campus if you don't have two working legs, right? Or they don't work as well. And so when I think about the University of Cape Town, when I think about South Africa, I was in Cape Town. And it's one of the most racist places I've ever been. And the way that white people treated me. I mean, I've been treated pretty bad in the United States, don't get me wrong, especially in California, where people think they're more liberal than they are. But in South Africa, I had some of the worst experiences of my life. I had a young South African, he was about 21, and I think the girl was about 22, calling black people monkeys, and they didn't understand why you can't do that. And they're like, well, we call all people monkeys. And I was like, there's a historical legacy behind this. And even when I explained it, they laughed it off, right? And so that was the thing. Those are the things that I was dealing with every day. And those are like the microaggressions, but they're also So I was just seen as my American privilege helped me out, right? But black South Africans, poor black South Africans especially, they're treated really bad. And the last point I'd like to make is that get out of the airport, and then you're driving to Cape Town, you pass Khayelitsha, which is one of the townships, and you see extreme poverty, you know, and then you see extreme wealth. And to see it, it's in a way that doesn't exist in the U.S. And it's in a way that, like, the infant mortality rate out there is ridiculous. The amount of people living within one place is ridiculous. And it's not their fault. And yet these white people, and even some black South Africans and other people of color South Africans who are of a higher class standing, will blame them for their own oppression, despite knowing the history of South Africa.
Anthony Williams studied in South Africa last year. He is now a Mellow Mays undergrad fellow at UC Berkeley, studying sociology, theater, and performance studies. He is also the Prison Divestment Communications Director and Editor-in-Chief of the African Black Coalition, an organization started in 2003 by black students within the UC system who found the low admittance and retention rates of black students intolerable. Sophie Karasik is co-founder of End Rape on Campus. She graduated from UC Berkeley last year, and she spearheaded several federal complaints against UC Berkeley. She's featured in the documentary The Hunting Ground, which exposes rape crimes on college campuses. And Angus Young is an historian of American student organizing, teaches at City University of New York, and runs the blog studentactivism.net. And let's hear from Mike in El Cerrito. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I wanted to mention the Facebook page, Everest College Avengers. And the reason for that is because it was instrumental in starting the Corinthian student debt strike last year. And it's an example of something that I think needs to happen for college alumni all over the place, which is to form an alternative alumni association. So typically an alumni association only wants to hear from you if you're doing really well and if you have money to donate to an endowment.
Right.
But there is no tool that alumni have for sharing issues that they're having with job placement or debt problems that they're having, and sharing resources that they may have in common to access those. And so I think the idea of an alternative alumni association could be really useful for people who are no longer part of a student body on a campus where they have easy access to each other and where they're just starting to be confronted by notices for paying their debt.
Yeah, it's a great comment. An alternative alumni association for things other than, oh, look, we have a new building that we'd like you to check out. Well, that's a great idea. Thank you for calling in, Mike. Let's go next to Arian in San Francisco. Hi, Arian. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to remark that universities are located in neighborhoods, and neighbors have a great opportunity, if not a responsibility, to partner with university students and staff. For example, I live nearby USF, and I wrote them a couple long letters requesting that they divest from the petrochemical industry. Well, I noticed that they don't even have one bulletin board available for any students in the campus to collaborate. And then they suppressed the letter. They didn't deliver it to the board, and the president responded to me with a nice small thank you note, but saying just focus on recycling. And I would encourage that the students and staff really open up their dialogue and try to get nearby neighbors involved and informed, because neighbors of all ages, even high schoolers, could really be helpful.
Yeah, it's a great suggestion. Thank you, Arian. And Sophie, those of us who live in the Bay Area are very close to a variety of campuses. What is the best way to get involved?
Well, I think that, you know, it really depends on what your relationship to the university is, so or to the local school is. So, for example, there are a lot of folks who are listening who are probably parents of kids who are in the K-12 system, for example. And Title IX, which prohibits gender discrimination in education, applies to K-12 schools as well as colleges. And so something that we really want to encourage states to do, and parents and alumni and faculty and students to push for, is for consent education, comprehensive affirmative consent education, and that fortunately is now something that's required in California for high school students, but many activists think that we should actually be starting these important conversations before college. So one way that a lot of people can get involved in their local communities is writing to their school board and saying, you know, what is being done to discuss these important issues about boundaries and healthy relationships and respect for others before students are going into high school, because a lot of students are engaging in this type of stuff when they're in middle school. And some countries, like, for example, Australia, and I think the Netherlands, too, actually do consent education starting in kindergarten. And so these are things that we can learn from. I think that it's important to be involved in your community in the capacities that make the most sense for you. If you're an alum of a school or an institution, you can write to your institution. You can potentially write to the school newspaper if there is one and get other people to sign on with you. Offer to mentor students if there's something that you think that you could contribute. And also something that I've been seeing alums do is in a variety of issues, is creating escrow accounts where they pledge not to donate to their institution until they see specific policy changes. And so that's another option that people can have.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Arian. We have time for one more caller. Let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi there. Years ago, I served as the president of my student government for an East Coast university, and we had the original Iranian crisis when the United States accepted the Shah of Iran coming into the country. And I found myself one day walking among campus and finding a huge protest going on. In fact, even burning our student newspaper in effigy. And within moments, with these hundreds of students protesting, a news truck pulled up, and it was an ABC Eyewitness News truck, and in search of the student leader, there I was, thrust upon talking to a reporter on camera. And I'd just like to say that I remember being very back then.
Frank, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. We have a bad line. Sorry about that, Frank. Can we let go of Frank? he wanted to say that he had to talk to the media. He was thrown in front of the cameras, and it was a really hard job. So he wants to applaud you, Anthony, and you, Sophie, for the kind of activism that you're doing, because you're students, and then you're taking on these issues, and sometimes you have a mic just stuck in your face.
Yeah, sometimes that just happens. Yeah. And what I heard him saying is that he kind of just became a leader in that moment. And Earlier you asked me, how do you get inspired? Sometimes you walk by. One of the first protests I did at Berkeley was for the graduate students who were protesting for better wages and for a gender-neutral bathroom. And I joined. I mean, I'm a sociology student, and I was like, what's going on? This sounds like, you know, I learned more about it, and I joined them. I didn't end up doing any interviews at that case, but sometimes that's what happens. You get thrust into it, and then you learn more about it afterwards.
Right, and in the case of you and the women in the hunting ground, Sophie, I mean, you're all talking about really deep and personal issues.
Yeah, it's definitely something that is difficult for a lot of survivors to do, and I think what we've really tried to emphasize to survivors who are in this movement is that there's no one right way to heal. There's no one right way to be an activist, and you don't have to be public if you don't want to, and you don't have to tell your story if you don't want to, because it's something that is so personal and is so difficult, and there's the threat of retaliation and further harassment, particularly if your assailant is still on campus or is in the faculty. So it's definitely something that we are approaching with a lot of care, and we really try to cultivate strong relationships with journalists that we know and we trust, so that we can make sure that people are sharing their stories on their terms. Mm.
And Angus, we don't have much time left. What are your final thoughts, hopes for 2016?
One thing I wanted to say on the subject of media is, again, I guess this is a hope for 2016 as well. One of the nature of the beast here is that these are amorphous grassroots movements, and in many cases people will have a microphone thrust in their face. One of the things I would really request from people of my generation, particularly people in the media and pundits, is that we recognize that the movements are diverse and that they are broad, and that if we are going to make a habit of gleefully pouncing on the thing that gets said that seems most ridiculous to us, we will never have a drought of things to leap on, but we also will be misrepresenting the movement, and we won't be treating this movement with the respect that it deserves. I think that it's important for all of us, whatever arena we're in, to treat people with a degree of charity in understanding what they are saying and what they are pushing for, and I think that is never more important than with outsiders looking at student movements. It's been very, very rare to see up till now. I hope we see a lot more of it.
We will definitely see a lot more of that on this show in 2016. Angus Johnston is an historian of American student organizing. Anthony Williams goes to UC Berkeley, and he is prison divestment director with the African Black Coalition. Sophie Karasik graduated last year from UC Berkeley. She's co-founder of End Rape on Campus and is featured in the film The Hunting Ground. Thank you all for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the diplomatic crisis between Iran and Saudi Arabia after the Saudi government executed a prominent Shiite dissident. We'll also discuss coverage of the State Department's response and Saudi Arabia's public relations campaign to shape how the news is covered here in the U.S. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.